Good morning, everybody, and welcome again to the Fed's quarterly regional economic press briefing. It's always a great opportunity for us to talk to you here, and by talking to you, talk to the people in our district. As Christian noted, though, I'm going to discuss both national and regional economic conditions today, with a particular emphasis on household debt, both in the nation and in this district, which, as you know, covers New York, Northern New Jersey, Fairfield County, Connecticut, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Following my remarks, my colleagues will provide a greater detail. As always, what I have to say reflects my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve or the Federal Open Market Committee. So turning first to the national economy, since the Great Recession ended in 2009, the economy has grown at a modest pace. When we last met in October, the available data showed we had hit a soft patch at mid-year. The recovery had slowed, and that pushed back the time before unemployment and inflation could be expected to return to levels consistent with the Federal Reserve's dual mandate. And with the loss of forward economic momentum, the downside risks to the economy had increased. In order to get that momentum going again and reduce those downside risks and speed up a return to more desired levels of unemployment and inflation, in early November, the Federal Reserve announced its intention to purchase an additional $600 billion of Treasury securities. And these purchases, I think, helped to ease financial conditions and have been an important aspect of why we're starting to see a renewed pickup in economic activity. As things have turned out, activity in the second half of 2010 turned out to be considerably stronger than most analysts had expected. Real final sales in the second half grew at about a 4% annual rate compared to just 1% in the first half of the year. This growth was led by strength in consumer spending, strong growth of exports, and slower but still healthy growth of business fixed investment. Several notable forces, I think, combined to generate this stronger growth. On the policy side, as I mentioned, the FOMC had provided further stimulus through purchasing Treasury securities. This, plus the effects of previous monetary accommodation measures, helped to improve financial conditions. Also, the Board of Governors Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey indicates that banks did begin to ease credit standards somewhat during the second half of 2010, although that was starting from an absolutely high level of tightness. The pickup in the economy has occurred despite weakness in the housing market. Home prices have softened anew, and construction activity remains stuck at a very low level. That reflects the continuing large supply of unsold homes. We believe that it will take more time, perhaps as much as another year, for enough of these homes to be sold so that residential construction might have the beginnings of a meaningful recovery. On the labor front, the most recent employment report for January is quite difficult to interpret. On one hand, only 36,000 non-farm payroll employment jobs were added, well below expectations. Yet, when we look at the household employment survey, we get a very different perspective, with the unemployment rate fell by 0.4 percentage points for the second month in a row, taking the unemployment rate down to 9%. Now, job growth in terms of the payroll employment report was undoubtedly held down by severe winter storms that affected many major cities, including our own. But the decline in the jobless rate was not an unmitigated positive either, as a significant portion of the decline in the unemployment rate was due to fewer people looking for work. So neither the disappointingly slow job growth, as measured by the payroll employment report, nor the steep drop in the unemployment rate, as measured by the household survey, seems to paint the full picture. The truth seems to lie somewhere in between. Despite the stronger job growth that we do expect in the months ahead, we do have substantial slack in our labor markets that will take a considerable amount of time to absorb. At this point, while this soft patch seems to be over and the risk of a double dip for the economy has subsided, we have to emphasize that the economy still faces headwinds as a result of the aftermath of the financial crisis, the housing bust, and the high level of unemployment rate that still prevails. As banks and other financial institutions seek to strengthen their balance sheets and avoid future credit losses, it's likely that they'll keep credit conditions tighter than normal for a while longer. In addition, many consumers' borrowing options may be limited by their impaired credit histories. And the recovery is not getting the strong boost from home construction that we have typically seen in past recoveries. Furthermore, as I will discuss later, households are still feeling the financial impact from lost wealth and lost jobs, which makes some cautious about spending and investing. So the economy is healthier, but it's certainly not well yet. In order to reduce joblessness significantly over the coming quarters, the economy needs to grow at a considerably faster rate than we've seen so far in the economic recovery. Now, I'm happy to say that we do believe that conditions are in place for faster growth in 2011 and 2012. We entered this year with a fair amount of forward momentum. Business and household spending has strengthened, presumably reflecting greater confidence in the economic outlook and progress in repair of household balance sheets. Businesses are expanding their investments in equipment and software at a healthy pace, and their spending on non-residential structures, such as office buildings and factory space, is no longer contracting as sharply as it was a year ago. Further support for the economy comes from the agreement by Congress and the administration to postpone some tax increases, to reduce payroll taxes temporarily, and to extend unemployment compensation benefits. In addition, our exports continue to expand, supported by strength in demand abroad, particularly in Asia. Higher growth, a steady reduction in spare capacity, and a continued stability in inflation expectations should also slowly begin to reduce the recent decline that we've seen in core inflation. Inflation was very low during the second half of 2010, but we expect that to be the low point of the cycle. In short, viewed through the lens of the Federal Reserve's dual mandate, the pursuit of the highest level of employment consistent with price stability, the current situation remains unsatisfactory. However, we appear now to be moving in the right direction. Now, how is our region doing? Well, overall, in contrast to the pickup in the nation, the regional economic recovery appears to have paused in the fourth quarter. More similar to the nation, though, the joblessness in the region has retreated somewhat from the peaks recorded towards the end of 2009. But nevertheless, joblessness still remains unacceptably high in the region. As attendees at previous regional press briefings may recall, the New York Fed publishes indices of coincidence economic indicators that help us monitor the performance of the regional economy. Based on these measures, the upturn in economic activity that we saw for much of 2010 in both New York State and New York City has paused. To be sure, activity in both the state and the city are higher than they were a year ago, but we saw no increase in the last quarter. This pause is particularly evident in New York City, where the economic recovery had been relatively strong. By the way, let me note that this pause in economic activity occurred before mid-December, so we can't attribute it to the recent spate of heavy snowstorms. By contrast, New Jersey's economy has seen no pickup in activity, and in fact, activity there has continued to decline at a modest pace through the end of 2010. For Puerto Rico, we monitor it using an index produced by the Government Development Bank of Puerto Rico. This index shows that the recession there, which started back in 2005, well before the recession experienced in the mainland, appears to have subsided. As of November last year, activity was no longer falling, although indications of a recovery are still mixed. Turning to the jobs picture, the latest data indicate that businesses in the region on balance were not expanding their workforces at the end of last year. As a result, the total number of jobs in the region has held steady, lagging behind the job growth rate that we've seen at the national level. Much of this recent weakness in employment stems from job losses in retail, wholesale, and manufacturing sectors in our region. In the rest of the nation, these sectors expanded during the last quarter. Moreover, our state and local governments cut jobs more severely than did governments elsewhere. At the same time, job gains in some of the region's strongest sectors, such as professional and business services, finance, education, and health, were not large enough to completely offset those losses. At this point, it's difficult to say whether the recent pause in job growth will be short-lived or not. As such, we'll have to continue to closely monitor the region's job outlook. Meanwhile, unemployment rates have ticked down across the region. Given the disappointing job numbers, it's not surprising that this change is largely due to a decline in labor force participation. In the fourth quarter of 2010, the labor force of both New Jersey and New York declined by about 0.3 percentage points, meaning that fewer people were actively seeking work. As a result, December's unemployment rate in New York and New Jersey at 8.2% and 9.1% remained below the national jobless rate of 9.4% for that month, but rates that nevertheless remain painfully high. Puerto Rico's 15.7% unemployment rate is down a bit from its peak of more than 17%, but still shows little evidence of sustained improvement. Now let me turn to the session's special topic, which is household debt. This topic provides an important lens into economic conditions both in the country and our region. How are families adjusting their savings, borrowing, and spending in the aftermath of the mortgage crisis and the Great Recession? That's going to help shape the path of the recovery. Here at the Federal Reserve, we're trying to answer questions such as what's happening to households' credit, debt, and delinquencies, and what economic consequences will that have? This monitoring and research on household debt and credit conditions helps us better understand the connections between financial market developments on one hand and the broader economy and family well-being on the other. We follow a variety of metrics, including lending activity, the level of interest rates, of interest rate spreads, survey data on lending standards, delinquency rates on loans, and home and other asset price changes. One new key source of information on household and debt credit conditions is the New York Fed's Consumer Credit Panel. As mentioned earlier, these data are now available for all of 2010. They come from a nationwide sample covering all households where at least one member has a credit report. The records tell us about five major categories of household debt: mortgages, home equity lines of credit, credit card, auto, and student loans. To set the stage, one can think about the recent path of household debt in three broad phases. First, the run-up to the recession, the years leading up to the crisis. During that period, households borrowed a lot of money. They took on higher credit card balances, auto loans, student loans, and especially mortgages. The second phase, as the crisis unfolded, many families' debt burdens proved to be unsustainable. Delinquencies rose dramatically and household debt began to fall sharply. Now we're entering the third phase, the process of gradual convalescence, as delinquencies begin to subside and some households begin to expand their borrowing again. Now, the nature of the run-up to the crisis, I think by this point, has been very well documented. So let me focus here on the latter two phases, the crisis period and the convalescence period. During the crisis, the weakness in the housing market contributed to financial strains for many families, especially those that found their mortgages were underwater. That is, that their homes were now worth less than their mortgage balances. As a result, they had no financial buffer they could tap if their finances came under stress. And as the economy weakened further, many households faced sharply reduced incomes as family members lost their jobs or had their work hours cut. So more families found it difficult to pay their credit card bills and other debt obligations on time. As a consequence of these strains, households began the painful process of deleveraging. They started to reduce the amount of debt they owed relative to their income. During the run-up to the recession, households were only saving about 2% of the income. Now they're saving around 6% of their incomes. This increase in savings was mostly used to pay down their debts, but it also included adding to their savings account and borrowing less. Of course, some of the reduction in this debt reflects loan charge-offs of bad debts, but work done here with the Consumer Credit Panel shows that some consumers were also becoming more frugal, rebuilding their net worth by paying down their outstanding borrowings. These actions enabled families to rebuild their financial reserves, precautionary funds that they could be used in the event of job loss or illness, and to maintain their consumption and keep up with their mortgage payments. But to save more, it also means they had to consume less, which dampened economic activity further. Interestingly, student loans are the only part of household debt that continued to rise throughout the crisis. More families and students may have needed to rely on loans to fund education during the difficult times. And going to school was more attractive for some, given the deterioration in labor market conditions. Just as households began deleveraging during the crisis, banks needed to respond in light of the large loan losses that they were taking. As defaults rose, banks tightened their underwriting standards and raised the margins that they charged on loans. As a consequence, they made fewer loans. This tightening of credit availability exacerbated the decline in real activity. We were in the middle of what we call an adverse feedback loop, in which the financial and real sectors of the economy were reinforcing each other, and that was deepening the recession. So where are we now? Well, there are several signs that we are now convalescing. This damaging dynamic, the adverse feedback loop, now appears to be beginning to reverse. From historical experience with financial crisis, we know that this phase is a gradual transition process, not a quick event, as households and banks slowly complete their painful financial adjustments. Once the adjustments are completed, households can consume more and regain their access to credit, and these developments can help support a more vigorous economic recovery. Of course, we don't know precisely where we are yet in this adjustment process. For example, families may choose a permanently higher rate of savings in order to rebuild their savings for their retirements. What they decide to do will depend in part on their expectations for future incomes, their outlook for the economy, what they think was going to happen to housing and stock prices, and prospects for taxes and benefits such as Social Security and Medicare payments. However, we do know that during good times, fewer households are likely to be delinquent on their bills. And overall, we'd expect their borrowing to grow at least modestly as the economy strengthens. The Household Debt and Credit Report released today indicates that there has been a pickup in credit flows. Households increased their non-mortgage debt last quarter. That's the first quarterly increase in 2 years. The number of credit card applications increased, an indication of a pickup in consumer demand for credit. And the number of open credit card accounts also increased slightly as more accounts were open than were closed. Of course, there's still considerable signs of distress. Households are still reducing their housing-related debt, and delinquencies remain at a high level and continue to be a problem. So the adjustments remain far from complete. But it is encouraging that credit flows are no longer contracting, because households' renewed demand for credit has no doubt supported some of the recent rise that we have seen in consumer spending. So what about trends in household debt in the region? One key question we're going to focus on today is how this process is playing out for households in the second district. In general, our region has fared well in comparison to the nation as a whole. Following the three phases of the cycle that I noted earlier for the nation, I will consider three questions. First, how much debt did households take on during the run-up to the crisis? Second, how much deleveraging has occurred throughout the region as we went through the crisis? And third, like the nation as a whole, are we beginning the convalescence process? Have households started to increase in borrowing again? And what signs of stress remain within this region? One reason that households in our region have weathered this credit cycle relatively well is that debt levels here are lower relative to income, and this debt rose more modestly in the run-up to the recession than compared to the nation as a whole. If we take the debt-to-income ratio as our metric, and we can use this to help make meaningful comparisons across different regions, debt levels are particularly low in upstate New York and in New York City. There are three key exceptions to this generalization, however: Long Island, Edison, New Jersey, and Puerto Rico, where household debt-to-income level ratios have risen to levels above the U.S. average. Since the vast majority of household debt is related to housing, it's not surprising that debt-to-income ratios were highest and rose the most in places that experienced the most rapid increases in home prices. So, for example, when you look around the country, debt-to-income ratios are among the highest in the nation in those places most associated with the housing bubble, namely California, Florida, Nevada, and Arizona. This relationship between home prices and debt burdens can also be seen within our own region. For example, household debt grew more slowly than nationally and has remained relatively low in upstate New York. That's because upstate New York was largely bypassed by the housing boom in the first place. In New York City, that's a little bit different. A large share of residents in New York City rent their homes. Thus, city residents still have relatively low levels of mortgage debt, even though those debt levels rose during the run-up to recession. Elsewhere in the region, debt levels tended to rise the most in places where housing prices increased the most. Those are areas such as Long Island and parts of New Jersey. Now, during the crisis, as was the case in the country, in most parts of the region, households did reduce their debts. But because they had not accumulated as much debt during the run-up to the crisis, the decline was well below the national average. In general, in households in our region, with some exceptions that I'll mention in a moment, have not been under as much pressure to deleverage. It's particularly notable in upstate New York, where debt levels are well below the national level. Households have actually continued to very slowly add to their debt. Clearly, deleveraging has not been particularly consequential for many upstate New York households. The deleveraging process in other parts of New York and New Jersey, which, while quite severe by historic standards, has proved milder than elsewhere in the country. Nevertheless, many families in the region have had to make painful adjustments to their spending in order to pay down debts. These families tend to be concentrated in neighborhoods where households took on more debt during the run-up to the crisis or sustained more severe income losses during the crisis itself. These factors contributed to delinquency rates that run well above average in certain areas, including certain parts of New York City and Long Island. In fact, some neighborhoods in these areas now have delinquency rates as high as 2 to 3 times the national average. Looking forward, we see some signs that the region is starting to turn the corner on the terms of the credit cycle. After declining during the crisis, credit applications have begun to increase, suggesting that the demand for credit is rising. Although housing debt is still declining and delinquencies are still high, households in many parts of the region have sought and taken on some debt in recent months. In particular, auto debt has been rising over the past year across New York, Northern New Jersey, and Puerto Rico, a signal that households in the region once again want to increase their spending on durable goods and are willing and able to borrow to do so. So to sum up, although the national economy experienced a pickup in activity during the last quarter of 2010, our particular region saw a pause. The loss of momentum locally is disappointing because until the fourth quarter, much of our region was recovering somewhat faster than the nation as a whole. However, I would not be overly discouraged by this. After all, soft patches are not uncommon during economic recoveries. Both nationally and regionally, unemployment rates remain stubbornly high, but many indicators suggest that conditions are in place for stronger employment growth in coming months. With respect to debt, households in most parts of the region are in better shape than the nation as a whole. Households in this region increase their debt burdens less during the boom and thus have less need to deleverage. In addition, there are emerging signs both nationally and regionally that consumers have begun to spend more and appear willing to take on some new debt. This bodes well, I think, for another step forward in terms of economic momentum, both for the nation and the region. However, high delinquencies in some parts of New York City and Long Island are a reminder that many households remain under significant stress. Thank you for your kind attention this morning.